the advocacy part where I circle back about kind of going into my community and working in these spaces is so important to me because on the surface, we'll say, well, women just aren't interested. It's like, are women not interested in technology? Or are women not interested in how technology's been being taught for the past 100 years, right? Are Latinos not as good in technology as white people? Or is it because it's being taught in a certain way for the past 100 years? People are, well, why should they have to change? They should be able to adapt. And I'm like, okay. So you're telling me like, I need to change to be like you, right? And you're like, yeah, that's not racism. You're like, no, that's not, it doesn't have to be racist. Like, you just need to learn how to do it the way we do it.
In this episode of the Plutopia Podcast, John, Maggie, and Scoop visit with the director of the New Media Lab at Texas A&M, Dr. Joseph Lopez. But you could just call him Joey.
Welcome to another installment of the Plutopian Madness, featuring Scoop Sweeney. Today, Maggie Duvall is joining us.
Hi.
I'm John Lebkoski, and our guest today is Dr. Joseph Lopez.
Hello. Greetings and salutations.
Also known as Joey Lopez.
Yeah, you can just call me Joey.
Joey's a graduate of the University of Texas at Austin of the Radio, Television, and Film Department, RTF program. And he was a teaching assistant to Professor Sandy Stone at the great Media Lab, ACT Lab, which was UT's Interactive Media Lab at the time. Joey's currently creating a new media lab at Texas A&M University, and he's continuing to follow the ACT Lab dictum: make stuff, take risks, and be awesome.
Yes.
So welcome. Glad you could join us.
Thank you. It was fun driving down here. Got to experience the toll roads. Didn't experience any traffic, which was very, you know, I was kind of heartbroken. I was like, you know, they build it up here. It's just brutal.
Unlike Interstate 35, which is just a fine place to be.
Yeah. But, you know, I have hopes for when I go back on 183 back east, it'll tighten up and I'll have to hunker down on a podcast like this one.
Nobody was driving today. They all had a hangover.
Exactly.
So, first thing we should ask about is the Convergent Media Collective. You're the founder of that. And I know it's following you from San Antonio to College Station as you moved to A&M. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's like literally following me. And that right before I walked in here, I got a message from some of the Convergent Media community members who are literally people that I met in San Antonio and do media and do kind of advocacy work. And they were like, yeah, we're coming to the A&M New Media meeting on Tuesday.
Oh,
and I was just like, oh, okay, wow, that's pretty cool. I mean, it was pretty surprising. I mean, it's a 3-hour drive. I do it every week, but I look up to those that are brave enough to come out and kind of check us out from San Antonio. So yeah, we had the Convergent Media Collective. It came literally out of the roots of the ACT Lab. So the way it kind of happened was that I wasn't charged with starting a Convergent Media program at the University of Incarnate Word in San Antonio. And when I was in the ACT Lab at UT Austin, as a student and then as a TA, one of the things that we did was we just kept having all these random meetups outside of the class, the actual class, whether it was in office hours or then just going to Sandy's house or whatever. So
borderless.
We kept it really borderless. And so that's what I did. I'd have students come over and we'd all make spaghetti. We'd literally like eat together. We'd go out and then we just started having meetups. And then, I also just hosted a lecture series. John, you came and talked with Dustin one time. And I mean, you may have come twice. I can't remember. It all runs together.
Yeah, this came once, but it was quite an experience.
Yeah. And so what I did was I just kept cross-pollinating Austin with San Antonio. And then we just created this crazy trajectory where next thing I knew, like the Convergent Media Collective itself was its own phenomena. One of the things that was really fun, though, was that ACT Lab had its own false history, which some people may or may not know about. There's this guy named T. Williger that they had kind of made as their own false history of how HackLab came to be. And so when we started the Convergent Media, the two founders, two students, literally went to like a thrift shop and found a painting and declared this person as our founder, Yebediah, and made a whole false history about how the Book of the Converger had been buried underneath our school's building, and literally made like multiple documentaries about this person and their influence on the converging of media.
Yeah, well, for our listeners, do you have a formal definition of convergent media?
That's a great question. Well, you know, convergent media, new media, emergent media.
Digital convergence.
Right, digital convergence. I think are terms that people have been using for the past 30, 40 years now, which is kind of crazy to think about. But what's interesting about it, what I like to think of it as, is newness. We're discussing new. So for example, 10, 15 years ago, what was new in convergent media? Social media, right? Well, social media is pretty much now part of production, right? And then the past 10, like 5 to 10 years, what's new? Big data, right? But big data has kind of even become regulated and is getting locked down more and more. It's not so much what they called in the HackLab a black box. We literally taught a course called Black Box where we talked about the idea of closure of social cultural phenomena and around like technological phenomena. So, you know, at what point do things become just it? So I was just at a meeting earlier today, and it was a climate and inclusion meeting. So about diversity and inclusion, about equity, about equality and things like that. And this group hosts a conference every year, and it's officially recognized in the past 2 years by the school, and is actually used for metrics to kind of show due diligence and promoting diversity and inclusion. And to me, that's kind of like when you start seeing the box close, you know, you start seeing that close up. So what I'm trying to do is just always wedge that box further open and always try and keep that dialogue going. So whether I'm teaching new media, convergent media, emergent media, what I'm ultimately doing, if you can imagine this, and it's literally like imagine this. So I take my left hand, I put it kind of by my face, and I say, if I take things that people are interested in, right? Like say people are interested in something, and then I take with my right hand and on the other side of my face, I go, and we take theory and skills and things that we're learning and picking up, right? And then I get my left hand and I put it over my heart and I like motion over my heart. I go, and we take our passion for things, right? And we rub these three things together like a hippy dippy way. We make stuff. And that's where, like, to me, convergent media, new media, emergent media fall. Because if we knew what that stuff was, we would say, we're gonna go and make X. We're gonna go and make this or that. But we don't, you know? And sometimes, yes, we end up making something that's already been made. Sometimes we end up making things that haven't been made. Sometimes we make things that haven't been made, but we don't understand and throw away. And then 15 years later, you're like, oh, wow, we could have used that. That would have been useful. And so a lot of, you know, the motioning with my hand when I say rub it together, that's actually the journey part. That's the part where maybe some people are really good at the technological tools. Some people are really good at the theory. Some people are really good at ideating and having the ideas. And then some people just have lots of passion, right? So the way I teach new media or convergent media, emergent media, is I do it at a very individualistic level. So each person in my classes do a project based around this principle that I just gave. I don't do any group work for a grade. I don't believe there is enough at stake for college students to collaboratively work together and create a project with split, you know, attention on a topic. So what I tend to do is all of my group work is, because I do group work, is all for fun. So it's all in class. I don't let them work on it outside of class because I don't want someone working on it more than the others. Yes. And I actually have them kind of be more like a cub-like competition between the groups of saying, hey, who can be creative? You know, this is the time to fail. This is the time that if you don't know what we're trying, the skill we're trying to learn, say it's videography or social media or whatever, say you're not really good at that part, speak up, say, I don't know this part. And someone that is good, like, let's get y'all working together and start learning. And because those of y'all that have already mastered this and kind of go, you know, usually put your hands over your body in a nonverbal way and say, oh, I already know this. It's like, yeah, but do you know how to be a leader in this? Do you know how to start creating and leveling up and working collaboratively so that when you go out into the workforce or you want to go and have a movement, right? Not associated with capitalism. Like, you know how to work and lead and be around people and get things done. And so that's a lot of what I do with new media or convergent media.
You used a key word, fail.
Right.
Do you teach your students the value of failure?
Well, I tell my students...
Not being afraid of failing.
My, if I ever come across as arrogant, I tell them to remember that the reason I can come across as arrogant is because I know I don't have to know everything, and I know I can ask for help. And those are two big things that most people are very afraid of. Right now, especially with our K through 12 in Texas and nationwide, K through 12 teaching, most students are following a rubric. It's like, you need to do this, 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 and this, and you'll get an A. You do this and this and this, you'll get a B. You do this and this and this, and you'll get a C. Okay? And like, you need to do that. So then the students will come and they're asking you, like, what's the rubric? And I go, well, I just showed you my teaching method, right? I go, the only rubric is the one that you make up. And I will sit down with you if you want and make a rubric with you so that you can know you're going to get your A, but it's going to be us working together and each one's going to be custom because everybody's different as to how you find that journey to making an A. Because I really am asking you, not so much can you meet this mark, can we all draw the same picture as to what is a picture? You know, when we work in the field of new, replicating old only goes so far. We'll do that in the not for a grade. We'll do that in our skills, modules. But when we're actually working for a grade, I'm looking for sincerity. That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for growth. You know, well, how do you quantify that? I'm like, oh, well, you're gonna find out, because the other side of what I have my students do, they do their project and then they have to show their documentation. Mm-hmm. They have to show their process. They have to show what they did and what they learned. And so most of the time, my students actually are able to come up with a grade that they think they made in the class and are usually pretty accurate. The other thing we do is we show all of the projects in class. So, you know, people are learning from each other. They're seeing each other's work. And what's the beauty of this approach is that you may have someone that knows how to fly a drone, uses DSLRs, is just you know, really great at production, but you may also have someone that uses their phone and is interviewing migrant farm workers about what it's like being literally in the field and what that experience has been like, and that has weight to it. And so, in a weird way, it's kind of like YouTube if you think about it. You know, it's that like it really levels the field. It's like, you can say, you know, we need a TriCaster and we need to have multi-camera shoots and we need HD, like 4K is not enough. I need 8K. I need this, you know, I don't know, Arri, you know, camera and all this stuff. But in actuality, at this point in time, in a very postmodern way, it's like your message is what people are engaging with for the most part. What do you have to say? You know, and we're not teaching I feel like we're not teaching people, especially K through 12, and then allotting and at the collegiate level, we're not teaching people to have a voice. We're teaching people to serve a purpose. Of the field that they're in.
And utilitarian.
I find it very problematic. On top of that, I find it very problematic because they're spending a lot of money. And at the heart of it, like, people are like, you sound like a capitalist. I'm like, well, I know the rules of the United States that I live in, and it is very capitalistic based. And so I know it's like, I can teach my students to not care about money. I can teach my students to do what they want to the detriment of whatever capitalistic consequences there are. But I want them to know why. You know, I want them to know, okay, well, but if I did want to sustain myself financially in this system and also push against it, how would I do that, right? Well, it's like we live in a debt-based society. We've got to learn how to not be in so much debt. We've got to take responsibility for the money that we're putting out. So I talk to my students and I tell them, I'm like, you know, whether you're paying for it, whether it's a scholarship or you're taking out student loans for this, I don't know too many 19 to 21 year olds that aren't in college that go, you know what I want to do? I want to get $50,000 and read books. I want to get $100,000 and read books and take tests over them. That sounds like fun to me. That's what I want to go and do. You don't meet too many people like that, yet all of you all in this class, when I talk to them, I'm like, all of you all have decided to do that. And y'all come in here, and some of you all, you know, don't realize your own agency in this. You know, you don't realize that, like, the power that you have. I also tell them, I go, the other thing that's really kind of hard to get across to people in college, and I think this was probably at any time, is that, what do you do when you graduate? You go to work. That's it. Like, you graduate, you go to work. Like, well, that's what most people are going to do.
Work could be more or less creative. It could be that you do something really entrepreneurial and interesting, or it could be that you just go plug yourself in somewhere and, you know, like a cog in a wheel.
Right. And so at the collegiate level, where do we give the intangibles to the students to know the difference? Right? Where in our pedagogical approaches, like in the way in which we teach, do we give our students the tools needed to be able to decipher the difference between having to go and take a job and deciding to go and take a job, having the skills and the cognitive understanding that if I go and work in this certain position at a big corporation, that may be beneficial to me, it may not, you know? Understanding starting your own business, being entrepreneurial, knowing the options. If I had just known X. Because the other thing I talk about a lot is that you all mentioned I got my schooling at UT Austin and radio, television, film. Well, I don't know if y'all know this, but in RTF, it's not like they just hand out a job when you graduate and they go, you wanted to be a filmmaker? Okay, now you're going to go to Hollywood. You're going to make $80,000 a year starting. In 5 years, you'll be bumped up to about 250. It's a very competitive space. If you just work hard, we'll bump you up to about 500 a million. You should be making pretty good money as a filmmaker, and the benefits are all there. And, you know, it's a pretty snazzy kind of lifestyle. That doesn't happen. In the greater sense, there's a communication, which is a department that I work in a field, the National Communication Association. Is like this whole respected field of study. They tend to have jobs that are like $30,000 to $50,000 a year. Well, if I have my students graduating and they're being plugged into those kinds of jobs and they're taking out $50,000 to $100,000, the ROI on that over a 10-year spread to me is not going to sustain or facilitate happiness over those 10 years. Unless you have some intangibles that come in and we start building in ways for these students to have experiences that, one, of course, push up their financial success, but also push up their feeling about what they're doing, their engagement about what they're doing, and having it feel rewarding. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and there's also a big component as you were speaking that I like, that one of those sort of intangibles maybe is in giving them the sense of self-directed learning, you know, that they can always reinvent themselves, you know, how to learn new things, you know, so that you're continually reinventing, relearning, right. You know, seeing new ways to apply tools, like, you know, instead of just there's this rote way of doing things. And that was something that was important to me when I was putting my daughter through school, you know, completely self-directed so that she can change how she needs to go at any time. And not be subject to the vagaries of different job markets or whatever. She can just hop over here or hop over there. But it feels like you're doing a lot of that.
Yeah, it's I call it like having a 21st century liberal arts degree. It's like, you know, the idea behind a liberal arts degree was that you'd have a rounded understanding of kind of critical and cognitive of thinking abilities. And I think that in the 21st century, it's like you need to have that plus some digital skills.
Program or be programmed.
Are there some, can you give us a few examples of some of the projects that have come out of your program that have really struck you or?
Well, you know, over the past, I guess, since 03 when I was teaching in the ACT Lab to today, there are a lot of different kinds of projects that I've seen people do that have been inspiring. And I think, like I said, some are technically brilliant, some are culturally, socially brilliant. So I'll talk about a couple different ones in a couple of different areas. So some technically brilliant ones I saw. One summer we had an English student that Brandon Wiley, a colleague of mine, and I mentored through Google Summer of Code, and he wrote an automated BitTorrent server. That was pretty cool. And it got on Slashdot and was a really big deal. And he actually had some VCs contact him about, you know, working with them to develop the idea further. And it was funny because he was like a sophomore English major. He's like, I don't know who these people are. I'm not going to deal with them. And then we've had all, you know, Brandon himself has been amazing in terms of peer-to-peer anonymity work. So peer-to-peer in and of itself, anonymity in and of itself, and then peer-to-peer anonymity in and of itself has been amazing to watch. I've also had students that have just had a really big breadth of projects. I had one student that named Amy Stedman, who some of y'all may know. She, when I met her, she worked at Monkey Wrench Books and volunteered there, and she wanted to make zines, you know, and so a big part of her projects were making zines about topics. And then
actual hard copies.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, hard copies. And then she did another project about synesthesia where like the seeing colors and hearing colors and things like that. And she used a Bluetooth adapter and a Wii remote and made it so that when she was talking, different colors would pop up on the screen. And it was funny because like the local news picked it up here in Austin and they like came and like did a story. So that was really fun. And I think that same semester we had someone build a laser harp. It may have been a different semester, out of just lasers from Walmart and some like LED sensors, IR sensors, and an Arduino, when Arduinos were just kind of hitting the scene. This was like, I don't know, 07, 08, yeah. Something like that. And that was really cool. That was like a really neat thing. And then, you know, Amy went on to go get her MBA, and then she her MBA group developed like this like lifestyle liqueur for college students called Beatbox, and they went on Shark Tank and got $1 million in funding from Mark Cuban.
Wow.
And so, you know, like you see these presentations in class and you're like, oh man, that's good. That one's, you know, people are going somewhere. And it's like, sometimes it's like, no, like they really are taking some of this stuff to heart.
Yeah.
I don't take credit for her brilliance, but I like to mention it every once in a while. And then, you know, I mentioned the migrant stories. I had a student last spring do a really cool project about her family as migrant farm workers and what that's been like her, you know, not talking about how her grandparents are migrant farm workers or her ancestors were migrant, but like how she and her family, you know, go work in the fields. And it's a really cool juxtaposition because I also had students at A&M that were doing stories about their family's farming industry and drone usage and kind of like the next level of farming in the same class. And it was really cool to see these two people sitting next to each other presenting in juxtaposition like these kind of lived realities, these social and cultural spaces, and both having a deep like respect for what's going on. It's neat. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting climate. I mean, being at A&M, it's a very, very conservative space, but a very cordial space. So people like really show a respect for each other when they present and show their works, which is really interesting and kind of different. Mm-hmm. People aren't dismissive as much. When I was at UT, people kind of would just write other people off sometimes. But here it's like a little...
The whole Media Lab thing is a little... I mean, like, right now we know there's this big issue with the MIT Media Lab and the kinds of things they were doing to get funding.
Right.
And I know, you know, Sandy had some interesting interactions with UT.
Oh, yeah,
she had the
sure.
Media Lab there. It's like, it's sort of like it's... It feels a little rogue, I think, to the universities, and they get a little nervous about it, maybe.
We often look like a cult, to be just blunt about it. And then it's like, if the university were to actually look at their mission statements, you would realize we're just following their mission statement, which is like to engage with the community and students and have a holistic understanding of what's going on and engage in discourse. And it's like, yeah, but you know, you're like really doing it. I mean, like, you know, y'all went to go eat afterwards. Like, what's wrong with you? Like, you gotta, can't you just leave your job? It's like, aren't we teaching people to like be passionate about and follow their dreams and all this stuff? Like, this is, you know, I tell my students, I go, isn't it really interesting that in kindergarten, they ask you, what would you like to be when you grow up? And you say, I'd like to be a fireman. I'd like to be an astronaut. I wanna be a computer programmer. You know, but when you show up with $100,000 to university, they don't go, what would you like to be when you grow up? They're like, this is probably what you're capable of. You should go do that. Mm-hmm. Now I'll take your money. In my opinion, it's a cop out. You know, it's a pretty big cop out for a money mill to like be able to
getting
have
much
that
guidance.
Attitude.
You huh? know, I don't remember getting much guidance when I was in university.
Right. And so, you know, what I try and do is not so much, and I learned this from Sandy Stone, you know, the founder of the ACT Lab. One of the things she really imparted on us, she gave like a presentation one time, and she had some illustrations that were kind of like, what is knowledge? This is knowledge, and this is knowledge here. And what we do with knowledge is we take the knowledge and we pour it into the vessel, which is the student, right? And Sandy would be like, let's just go back to what is knowledge and forget about that, because that doesn't matter. What is knowledge? Like, what are we imparting? What does that really mean? What does it really mean? Like, how can we pour knowledge from the vessel back in into the dictator, right? Like, not like dictator, but like literally the dictation of these ideas.
It's a question of whether it's a noun or a verb, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
Knowledge is a process. It's not really an object, you know, or a bunch of objects. Yeah.
We would hope. But it can get very, it can, the dialect you use, how you speak, how you talk. One of the things you notice about me is I don't have a huge Western European dialect. It doesn't come out if y'all are waiting for it. It's not going to happen, right? And so does that mean I can't engage in the discussion of knowledge, right? And what does a discussion of knowledge look like at a high level? Is it having a huge vocabulary? And when you get into academia, right, they start they start creating that ivory tower.
I've been exposed to some people recently who are, they're really kind of tied into philosophy, and it's been really hard for me. It's like, I just can't deal with the abstraction, and I realize that over the years I've grown less and less abstract and more, I mean, kind of the way I feel about it now is that all that, those like philosophies that people dream up and abstractions that they work with, it's all kind of like bullshit. And you know, you've really got to get anchored and be like, you talk about making stuff and being awesome. That's not a philosophy. That's a practical, like, let's right. do it kind of thing, you know?
Well, and I do try and live by that. You know, I run a hi-fi store outside of I run Dreaminoids Hi-Fi. It's in San Antonio. I drive 3 hours each way every week to run it on Saturday and Sunday from 12 to 5. And, you know, it's a passion of mine. I have to put my time in to make it work. And I have a business partner, and we've gotten to grow, and we've gotten to implement a lot of things that, like, and in ways that a lot of other people haven't had the privilege of doing. I noticed it's a privilege of mine. And it wasn't a privilege because I'm privileged. I started it when I was broke and had no money. And literally I'd lost my job and didn't know what I was gonna do with my life. So it wasn't like I just was rich. But what I did do, and what my business partner and I agreed to, was we did all in cash. And it's a very different thing than a lot of people that start businesses and take out a small business loan or any kind of other loan and start paying themselves out and building this thing out. It was like, we knew that our business, whether we put 100% in or put in the time that we're putting in, is like literally gonna take 5 to 10 years to be successful. Because selling hi-fi is a very niche thing, if you can imagine. It's all handmade in England. And there's only so many people, and there's only like it's kind of like in Spinal Tap when he's like, we over promoted. It's like I could have seen us over promoting quite a bit, and it's just not returning people coming in, because who's really buying hi-fi? You know, how do you build trust with people to pay $5,000 to $50,000 with you for a hi-fi, for a system to listen to? It's not some marketing. It's not direct marketing mailers. It's not emails. There's relationships that have to be built. We've been building them, and we're making money.
Well, that's what you're really passionate about. I mean, like, you're a creative, really creative guy, and you're a media maker, yet you have a passion for going and running a hi-fi store where you're selling stuff to people. And to a lot of people, that wouldn't feel like it's a very creative thing, but it sounds like you're finding something in it that really appeals.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we have a whole story. I mean, first of all, our business is not in like where you would expect it. You know, I had a customer come this weekend and he's like, so like, how did y'all decide on moving here? You know, like kind of looking around outside, and I'm like, well, you know, my business partner had an arcade. He had a building. This is it. He's like, well, so this is on the west side. I'm like, yeah. He's like, you know, when I used to grow up here, like there were like prostitutes and like, you know, drugs and stuff. I'm like, oh, it's still here. Yeah, you know, it's still here. I go, but you know, 100 years ago, my ancestors had a bakery 2 blocks down. You know, my ancestors are buried in the San Fernando Cemetery right down the street. You know, this area has meaning to us. And so, yeah, so it's a place that is, it's, you know, one of the things about selling hi-fi, and then the way we sell it, the way we decided to sell it, is that it's basically like you get to be an anthropologist and a salesperson at the same time. You know, you're meeting and learning about everybody's culture, because everybody that buys hi-fi, I don't care who you are, is a character. Most, I would say 90% of them could be out of a movie. Okay? And so you just meet interesting people over and over and over again. And normally they've been somewhat successful in life, because like I tell people, you don't have to buy hi-fi. There is no reason to buy hi-fi. I mean, you might need to buy a toilet, okay? But you don't need to buy a hi-fi. And then you really don't have to buy a $5,000 to $50,000.
Speak for yourself, man. I have to have one.
Yeah, see? but are you normal?
Well, okay.
Oh, touche. Could you be in a movie? Touche, right? Like, and that's what I'm getting at is, and we could sit down and have a conversation like on a podcast or something, you know, and like we're doing right now. And that's what I mean is that, so I end up running into just really interesting people. I've run into people that grew up in the neighborhood and grew up behind the public libraries, and they realized that they had gone to the same high school together. One is a professional electrical engineer, so like fully certified. And the other is a trumpet player in the United States Air Force. And then also plays for the San Antonio Symphony, you know, on when called. And so it's really crazy to have people like that come in and be like, man, we never thought somebody would come into the Barrio and like open up a hi-fi store. Like, this is crazy. And so it's been real interesting. And my business partner, he's 10 years younger than I am. And like I said, he ran an arcade. Before he ran an arcade, he worked for Apple Corporate. Before that, he was one of my students. Currently, he's a police officer, and that's what he does full time. And so, you know, it's like I'm always looking for interesting things going on. And this has definitely been an interesting, I drive every week. And I'm sitting there going like, why, you know, sometimes I'm like, why am I doing this? Like, why am I driving? Like, well, one, there's, I love you, Brian, but there ain't much going on in College Station that I need to be engaging with on the weekends. But like football, I'm like, I went to UT. Okay? And we won a national championship when I was there. I've seen enough football. Like, we won, like, I don't know. It's not that interesting to me. And I didn't care about football then either. But, you know, it's not like we're going to, I don't know, have that much happening in football anyways. So I, you know, I go back there and I keep finding and running into interesting things. Like a couple of weeks ago, well, let me wind back up a little bit. I'm really civically engaged in San Antonio. Right. So what I mean by that is that I go out and find out what's going on in my town. And I try and advocate and work with communities. Not at a charity level, but at like a grassroots, like go and meet and talk to them and see what's happening. So I've worked on a ton of projects. If you go to the cmcollective.org or to openedsa.org, you'll see a bunch of projects I've worked on. And through that, I've gotten to know all kinds of people. I know the Castros, Julian, you know, who's running for president, Joaquin, who's our congressperson, and Diego Bernal, who's our state rep for 123. And then I, in general, know who's on city council, at least know of them, if not know them personally. Like I know my district council person in my area. And one of the things that happens is that I always tell people I'll show up to anything. You ask me to show up something, I'll come. So it's like, y'all are like, hey, come do this podcast. I'm like, all right, I'm there. We just got to figure it out. And so I had met the woman that's the community event coordinator for Google Fiber in San Antonio. I met when she gave her first talk, I went and I was like, man, I want to see how this is going to go down. Because like one of the things I had done a couple of, I want to say weeks before she came in, it was pretty fresh, was I had done research and figured out that San Antonio is 460 square miles and LA is 469. And I was like, how are they going to decide where to start digging? And how much do they know about the fact that like AT&T was rooted here? You know, yes, it's in Dallas now, but it was rooted here and they just flip switches when competition comes in. Even Alphabet, right? Even Alphabet can show up and be like, hey, we're gonna like start digging up and cost them. And they're like, you know how many lobbyists we have? Like, you know, like they don't even have to say it. They just start flipping switches. And so it was really interesting to kind of see her have to navigate working with the communities to find buy-in on having Google Fiber come in. And it ended up getting delayed very heavily, and it was really tough. But I always followed up with her, and I always wanted to meet with her and just find out what she's doing on a personal level, the kinds of works. And so one day she texted me like a month ago, and she says, hey, there's this nonprofit. Do you have like a student or somebody that could shoot some video on a Saturday for us? it's not related to Google Fiber, but I was just wondering. And I said, sure. And I said, just tell me where it is and I'll show up. Like, I want to do this. I love doing little projects like that. So she sends it to me and it's 2 blocks from my shop. Literally, like 2 blocks. It's like I walk 2 blocks over and there it is. And it's at this community space that's an outdoor amphitheater that's fenced in. Currently they have like you would see at a carnival or at any kind of big event, they just rent a fence and fence it around this place because they've had too many people that are doing drugs, prostitution, all these things happening in this area. And so I show up, they've opened up the gate and I just kind of, I walk in and I start taking some photos and what it is, as I come to find out, because I end up seeing all these people I know, is it is an effort by the District 5 Council's office, which is Shirley Gonzalez, and by the pharmacy there called Davila Pharmacy, and some business owners. This woman runs a bar called La Botanica on North St. Mary's in San Antonio. Rebel Mariposa is what they call her. And they have decided to not only have the space open and encourage people to like utilize this space because it's been, they want to like try and take it back in terms of aura and space. They have figured out how to put together like a pre-colonial indigenous healing space on.
Wow.
So they have like an altar, they have limpias happening, they have like dance and movement happening, they have sound and movement happening, they have massages happening, they have people cooking food. And when you walk in, you sign some papers, you get your blood pressure checked. There's licensed psychiatrists and counselors there to help people with intervention. Their pharmacists are there. And I was just like, wow, like, I was like, you know, Google Fiber, maybe whatever it is. But this is, I'm so glad that she has been here in this community to like facilitate things like this. Like, this is awesome to see that kind of advocacy work happening. And so I came in, and it was funny because they didn't see who I was right away, and I started taking photos and stuff, and they came up to me and were like, who are you? And I'm like, I'm Joey. And they're like, oh yeah, we all know you. And I was like, yes. They're like, well, who are you doing this for? I'm like, you all, y'all asked me, Clarissa over there asked me to come. And they're like, oh, okay. Well, where are you gonna put these photos? I'm like, I don't know, I'm giving them to you all. Y'all put them where you want. I'm gonna shoot some videos and some testimonies. And so for me, there's a like new media. When I say we have to have our passion, it's like, I have my business, but my business also has this whole microcosm that's happening around it. They're all like, it helps me stay civically engaged in San Antonio. On November 9th, I'm going to host a civic engagement bar camp there. So a bar camp is an unconference conference where people come together and share ideas. And so it's like, I found some more people to invite and be like, hey, I'd really love for y'all to come. I've got the UTSA Center for Civic Engagement. I've got some people from Trinity. I've got some people from the city's Department of Innovation that are interested. And I'm like, you know, how do we create sincerity? You know, that's what we're missing on a lot of levels in society as it is right now. I mean, John saw me getting into it with some friends of his on Facebook. And and I was just kind of like, look, like we can say our ideas are dumb to each other. Yes, that is like what 90% of social media does. I get that. But like, where's the minutia? You know, where do we re-engage and go like, yeah, I don't agree with you, but let's talk about it. Let's figure this out. Well, I don't need to re-educate you. I don't need to do this. Okay, fair enough. But we're not gonna get anywhere. Like, we're not going anywhere. Things aren't changing. And that's kind of where I kind of find this otherness in me to go and change things. I mean, even at my university, at the faculty level, you know, a big thing at universities, all universities, and A&M includes that. Diversity and inclusion is a really big deal right now because it's federally mandated, mm-hmm. by the way, asterisk, because it's federally mandated, and Title IX and a bunch of other things have become down the pipe that are making, in a good way, in my opinion, are making people have to engage and face this.
It can be really hard to sort of engage with somebody in a way that you're challenging them, like that guy on Facebook. Yeah. You know, kind of what I said to him. Well, he isn't normally like this.
Yeah.
Well, maybe he is, but I said that because it kind of gives him an out. And, you know, you kind of have to figure out, people do need to be challenged a lot, but on the other hand, you want to do it in a way that doesn't make them get kind of like entrenched in their position,
right.
and get their back up, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You see that too much in any political discussion. There's no meeting of the minds. It's the clashing of the minds, maybe. Or But, you know, one thing I wanted to point out, your project you just talked about, you... being invited in to,
getting to document,
and that's kind of a secret to doing interesting media is don't turn things down. Mm-hmm. That if you find out later that it's really bad, you sure turn it down, but don't just say, oh, I don't have time for that, because you would have, if you'd have done that, you would have missed a really great opportunity. So I always tell people that I talk to about media is, be open. Just because it may not be in your wheelhouse, go check it out. You may come away with something you really didn't expect to find.
Right. And the other thing I do a lot is I depower myself as much as possible. So when I'm in positions of power, I always try and depower myself. And when I'm in other people's spaces with quotes around it, like I try and depower myself as much as possible. So when someone comes and asks me, what are you doing? I'm like, whatever you want me to do. Like, this is your space.
In other words, you theoretically hold the power, but you're not trying to.
Well, I could be like, well, my name is Joseph, Dr. Joseph Lopez. I'm here to it's like, who the fuck are you? Get out of here, Get the fuck out of here. I have a $10,000 camera with me and I'm gonna do these things because y'all told me to. So I don't know who you are, but I was told I could be here.
Yeah. Hollywood media approach
right.
that I used to encounter when I lived on the West Coast was that exact thing you just demonstrated of people storming in to take charge of the project. And usually that has a really bad outcome.
I was in all kinds of situations where I just needed to shut up and be a fly on the wall. And one of the things I learned to do was just do that a lot more. And so by the time I'm speaking a lot, I kind of feel a little self-conscious. But I'm also learning how to kind of handle that now, especially being at A&M. If I was at UT, it would be the same way. So I'm not picking on A&M as a university. I mean, any white-dominated university that population has a large percentage of minorities that aren't there. So, these are land-grant schools. They're here to serve the public, mm-hmm. yet their numbers don't reflect the population for which they serve. That's what I mean by that. And so when we talk about diversity and inclusion and things like that, that's what I'm really referring to, is that I'll go to meetings and it's predominantly either white female with some males or half and half, saying, how do we get more people involved? How do we retain more Latinos and African Americans? And I'm like, I'm, and at this point, it's like the graduate programs are diverse. The undergraduates a little diverse, but they just can't, see the faculty needs to be diverse. The faculty, the administrators, you all need to give up your power and show equity. And it's a very, very hard thing to do. In my field, in the communications field, I don't know if I call it my field because I kind of rejected it for the longest time. I still do, but I have a lot of professional colleagues that practice it. But our, the most distinguished award from the NCA, I believe has 90% white awardees, if not higher than 90%. And then about 85% male. And it's like, you know, what does that say about systems of power? I'm not saying that these people are racist. I'm saying these systems, whether they understand they're racist or not, are racially biased. And that's a big, you know, that's a hard thing to swallow. That's a very, very hard thing to swallow. And it happens in like other spaces too. It's not like you go to, you can have that happen at a Latino school or a historically black university.
Well, but in the tech industry, it's...
yeah, it's blatant. Yeah.
Very blatant.
And so it's one of those things...
But they keep saying they want to increase diversity, but no one really wants to increase diversity in their area because they might lose their job.
Well, but it can be hard because the question is,
it's you know,
whether yeah, and people have to show up. I mean, you know, I'm part of a tech co-op. Our tech co-op would be very open to having more women, more like blacks, more Latinos, whatever. But where do we find them?
Right,
where,
and that's
can
where
actually do that work.
That's where equity comes into play. And equity is so, like, most people don't understand what equity is, right? I mean, equality means that we all equally get, you know, you brought coffee out, so all of us get a thing of coffee. Well, equity is like, okay, who's the sleepiest? Okay, they're going to get the most coffee. But I wanted coffee. It's like, no, like, you're the sleepiest. We need you to be performing up with us, so we're going to give you some extra coffee, John. John's like, thank you. How did you know? It's like, because... we've looked and like, you know, through your lineage, like you had a harder time getting coffee than the rest of us. And so we want to make sure you're awake and ready to go. And that's schooling, right? That's like parental supplementation of like having parents go to schooling to help raise their kids and putting kids in good environments. That's why the advocacy part where I circle back about kind of going into my community and working in these spaces is so important to me because, on the surface, we'll say, well, women just aren't interested. It's like, are women not interested in technology? Or are women not interested in how technology's been being taught for the past 100 years? Right? Are Latinos not as good in technology as white people? Or is it because it's being taught in a certain way for the past 100 years? People are, well, why should they have to change? They should be able to adapt. And I'm like, okay. So you're telling me like I need to change to be like you, right? And you're like, yeah, that's not racism. You're like, no, that's not, it doesn't have to do with race. It's like, you just need to learn how to do it the way we do it. And I'm like, all right.
Well, you know that the biggest problem with white privilege is that
seeing it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're people who are white don't necessarily see that they're privileged,
right?
You know?
What? And, yeah.
Well, and just tying in with what both of you are saying, I was thinking about earlier, like when you were talking about philosophy and the double speak and the highfalutin talk and all that, I just gave up a long time ago conversing with a lot of people who are trained in rhetoric or logic because I'm very intelligent, but the way I think is completely different. I express myself in a bunch of different ways, with my hands, with sketching things out, with whatever. I see these big concepts, but I don't think in linear terms. And it was always, you have to express that way. I'm like, well, okay, I can't do it then. I just can't.
Rhetoric and logic are often weaponized.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Well, do you think the cost of education is a big impact on diversity? You were talking about the $50,000.
So there's some weird things going on in that area because the quick answer is no, culturally, and the long answer is definitely. But it's also for everybody. That's actually, in my opinion, that's a economic, a societal issue. It's beyond race. It's like you can even be white and not have money. Like, because the upper echelon have so much more money than the people that are poor, period. Whether you're white, black, or brown. And yes, you do have less likeliness being a minority. But in my opinion, it's tough for anybody to, in cash, pay $50,000 to $100,000 a head per child to go to school, right? Like, in cash. Like, if you have four kids, it's like, okay, $400K in cash, do it, right? Well, what do you need to have coming in? What do you, and so, so right now, the what the American quote, and I'm putting this in quote, answer is, well, they just take out student loans. You know, you just take out student loans, you take out student, okay, but now we've created a bunch of indentured servants. Yeah. We've also created a culture that I don't think the universities thought about when they were so happy to take all this money in, is because when you take this money in, you should extrapolate it out a little bit. Why? Because you ain't getting any money back from these kids. They're not gonna give you money back. They hate you. You're making them pay, you know, $300 to $1,500 a month in perpetuity, basically, you know, for like 5 to 20 years. And you're gonna call and be like, hey, you know, you got your degree with us. Wouldn't you like to give us some money? It's like, I'm paying the money. Like, I don't have any money. Like, you tapped me out. You didn't set me up for financial success and wealth over the long run. And so you're not gonna get that money back. And so it's creating a different kind of reality, a really weird one. Like, UT calls me and asks me for money, and I have some kid asking me, you know, like, hey, like, can you get, I'm like, I don't have any money. I have $150,000 in student loans. My wife has $150,000 in student loans. You know what we have a house of? Knowledge. That's it. You know what I mean? Like, there ain't no mortgage. Like,
yeah, I get the same thing from the University of North Texas. Right. I graduated 50 some odd years ago.
Yeah.
And they, every year, they're still like, no, I'm still
Back when we were at university, it didn't cost anywhere near as much.
Yeah,
as
well, I saw more diversity when I was on campus in the late 60s at UNT. It was North Texas State University then. And I visited a few years back, and it didn't seem all that diverse, because when I was there, I paid $75 a quarter.
Right.
Full load of classes, you know, books were pretty high.
Yeah.
But I had a lot of African American friends, Latino friends,
right,
Asian friends on campus. I saw a lot less diversity.
This is the example I give people that are like, oh, you know, people just need to work hard. I go, okay, cool. Let's take like a like what I would call a fiscally conservative Republican stance on this. You need to pay cash for school and you should go to work. Okay. Well, let's say in the summer, if you worked 40 hours a week and you got paid $100 an hour for 2 months, how much money would you make? Okay, 40, that's $4,000, right, a week. So that would be $16,000 in 1 month. That'd be $32,000. Okay, how much money do you need to go to school? People are like, well, if you think about it, Joey, there's like a $5,000 or $6,000 discrepancy there. I'm like, cool, man, y'all are smart. I'm like, okay, so who's paying $100 an hour to a student that doesn't have any skills? I get paid $100 an hour as a consultant, maybe $150 on a good day. Okay. So now we're really going like, oh, because you were like, Joey, you're being foolish. There's a couple of $1,000 spread in there. They only need to spend like maybe $15,000, $20,000, and then they can, you know, that should be enough to live. And I'm like, yeah, it should be, shouldn't it? At $100 an hour, working 4 hours a week for 2 months.
It would work if you don't eat or pay rent or go anywhere.
So that's kind of like how I often try and get people to understand how much more they're charging for school and how much more fluid they've made it, because both parents and children aren't taking out literally $10,000 in cash and counting it over the table in pain, as I call it, and say, hey, here's your $10,000 for this semester. I'll see y'all in a semester with the other $10,000. Or, oh, here's $20,000, you know, for the full year. Just hold on to that. I got more. And we don't do it that way. We just sign it. It's all electronic. It's all like, you see it all move. And so it's a very, we're in a really weird time where the value of having a degree is in flux. Not because people are getting less knowledgeable or because the degrees themselves are bad, but because of the value that they're costing, like the cost of them, has become disproportionate.
Well, you might almost suspect that there is maybe like this conspiracy to restrict education to people who are already wealthy.
Right.
You know? I don't know that that's true.
Well, and that it's a racket in terms of financial aid, because you can't default on it, right? The banks have it made. We, the taxpayers, pay it all off. We're in terms of us like forgiving the loans. And the banks, you know, we just pay the banks back their money. We just get the banks back the money.
So what do you think about
our bad lenders?
Bernie's plan to just kind of open it up and give everybody an education?
Oh, it makes complete sense to me. Yeah, I think education should be free, and I think we should be able to pay for it out of our profits as a country. And people that don't think that, I understand why they think that. I don't agree with it. One of the things you'll find out about me is I'm a pretty big centrist. So that's why I say, like, I like to dialogue. So I'm not going to be like, well, those people are dumb, you know, that don't know. They're this and that. It's like, that's not going to get us anywhere. I understand someone that lives in a great neighborhood, has a decent economic value around them, are going to sit there and be like, I don't understand why I need to pay all these taxes, you know, why I need to have taxes for these highways and these streets and these police and pay for people's food and pay for this and pay for that. It's like, I understand that because you don't live that. Like, I understand your logic. I see how you got there, okay? But at the same time, I'm like, okay, but now we look at the urban cores, we look at these spaces that people are in that are affording you to be where you are because of economic growth that they bring because they work for certain wages. You are living off of them whether you realize it or not. And that in and of itself is causing the need for those roads, causing the need for food, causing the need for education. Because if not, what you will end up living in is a third world situation where, yes, now your little safe space has been relegated to a gated community that you come in and out of. You have private police at your HEB, which we have. You have services that are literally kind of making you a quasi-safe space as you move around, but you don't have the same kind of freedom for which you thought America represented, because you're not putting the money in to the public.
Well, one way to think about taxes
is... public sphere, as we want to think about it.
If you want to live in a great house,
right,
in a great community, you probably pay a lot for the house, you pay a lot for, like, neighborhood association, whatever. So why shouldn't you have to pay a lot to live in a great country?
I think one of the reasons is that you shouldn't. Not that I agree with this, but I think one of the things that they would argue is that I can do it better. I can manage it better. The government wastes my money. And so I would rather pay private people to do this. And part of me says, I agree with you. And part of me says I don't personally, because like I said, I'm a centrist. So it's like, in some spaces I'm like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. In some places I'm like, no, this, it gets too nepotistic. But then you can also be like, well, it gets too nepotistic. It's like, for example, I'm super controversial because it's like a lot of people are mad at Trump about Biden. And I'm kind of like, well, I mean, Biden's son did have to, you know, step down from his position, you know, and Trump's like, this is tit for tat. You know, I'm just doing what they're doing. And I'm like, yeah, you are, you know, and y'all all suck. How about that? You know, like, I know you thought I was going to say like, yeah, and you're good because you're like, you know, you're sticking it to him. You're not sticking it to him. You're just doing the same thing they're doing, and I didn't like them either. You know, so it's like you're no better in my eyes for saying that. Like, you know, we're all just sucking off the teat of America with austerity. It's like that does not inspire confidence for me either. And I didn't like Biden either as a candidate. And so, you know, to me, it's all the same. Y'all are the same. That's why I said, like, y'all are. You know, you posed it up asking, you know, what.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I mean, if you say something bad about the Democrats, then that means that you're a Republican. Or if you say something bad about, but you know, you've got to be careful to say something bad about everybody, and that way it's clear that you're an independent.
And that's what I do.
Nobody owns your brain.
Well, you know, I'd like to circle back around to the beginning when I ask you a definition of convergent media. And from listening to you, it seems that that definition is kind of a moving target. It changes.
Oh, yeah.
Where do you see convergent media? Well, I'm not going to say 5 years because God knows. In a year or two, where do you see it moving?
Well, I'm not going to say anything that that somebody hasn't already said, but I'm going to try and contextualize it in a way that maybe hits home. I don't know. So the way I look at things in life, so the short answer is big data. I think big data is even bigger than we're talking about it. I think it's bigger than what people realize is happening. I think because we can't see it, we don't quite understand the magnitude. So what I try and do is I do a little demonstration in my class. I pick up my cell phone like I'm doing right now, and I ask my students, which I'll ask you all, what inputs do we have on this phone? Like, what kind of things do we have on this phone that like inputs data?
Are you talking about the hardware?
Well, it has a camera, yeah.
The hardware inputs?
Yeah, we'll talk hardware first, and then we'll talk about like some manipulation with
apps.
You've
got keyboards, you've got camera,
we got a screen.
You've got a microphone.
Right, so if we were to have like a Y access, we would say like camera, and then stack up microphone, and then stack up GPS, right?
Yeah, GPS.
Yeah, accelerometer.
You have gyro stabilization.
Yeah, gyro stabilization. We have a LED flashlight. Mm-hmm. We have, I think it has some IR on it. I can't remember. Some IR maybe.
Yeah.
What about app-wise? Like what kind
of apps? It's got Bluetooth.
Yeah, Bluetooth, right? Mm-hmm. We're just moving up this axis, this X-axis, right?
And it's all being stored somewhere.
Right, and it's being stored, right? And so we have, but we could probably, if we started talking about apps like, I don't know, Strava. Like I use Strava for writing. It uses GPS to track my ride. I have a power meter hooked up to it, which is like taking accelerometers and figuring out how much power I'm putting out at the crank. I have a heart rate monitor I have hooked up to it. It's really cool. I love it. There's a lot of different apps like that for all kinds of things, right? We can track all kinds of stuff, right?
Got those microscopes.
All kinds of accessories. So you can generate, in terms of x-axis data, we can generate all this data, right? And then we have y-axis. And then we have our x-axis, right? Which could represent time, right? So if we have time and we have this y-axis that has all these data points, okay, when are they being used? Okay, so, you took a photo. What was the GPS? What was the temperature of the phone? What was this? What was that? Okay, so in 1 second, how many plots do you think we have, right? In 1 hour, how many plots? In 1 week, 1 year, 5 years, how many plots do we have, right? So that's data. So what's big data? Big data is adding a Z-axis, right? What's the Z-axis? All of our phones lined up, right? So we have like this Z-axis, and then what's like the mega of that? The interaction, being able to extrapolate data across the Z-axis using the Y and X points.
Data mapping of communication.
In real time. And that's where we're gonna see new apps. We're gonna see things that are AI-like. You know, when we're talking about AI, because a lot of people are like, we're not at the singularity, we're not. I go, we're at a pretty good AI point where it seems like magic in a lot of ways.
Yeah, AI just doesn't mean what people think it means.
Right, right. I mean, people are going to move that goalpost down the road.
Yeah.
But we're getting pretty close to what we think of as AI for a lot of things because we're being able to extrapolate and process data like that in real time. And so to me, the future of, you know, new media is going to play a role in that extrapolation and then in that experience. And is that good, bad, or in between? Yes. Yes, it is.
All the
above. We talk about government surveillance. Well, it's going to be horrible.
Already is.
Yeah, it already is.
Yeah, there may be a Stingray installation right outside the door here, and you'd never know it.
I'm sure they're listening to us right now.
Well, the thing is always listening, and that's the thing is that like all our phones, everything. Like I assumed that in 2010. I gave a presentation. I'm like in 2010. I'm like, yeah, we're already. People think like what you've done hasn't been tracked. It's 9 years later, so it's kind of like.
Well, on a more positive note related to that, just you giving that example reminds me of a friend who talked about he was comparing the leaps in consciousness associated with like when we had the first telescope. And then the lens on the telescope got bigger and bigger and bigger. And like now and then we had Hubble. And, you know, he was just comparing like, you know, major shifts in consciousness and knowledge and all that.
Right.
And how amazing that was. And when you're doing that, it made my head explode because I was thinking along those lines too. Like, how would you, when you take that, suddenly you have a shift and you're seeing completely differently.
Right.
That's exciting to me.
Well, and I think that's what the internet did for us. I think that's what's happening with social media right now, is that, we talk about technology determinism versus social determinism. You know, when I teach social media right now, I ask my students, I go, do you think we act for social media or do you think we do social media? You know, are we a simulacra? Are we representing something that never really existed at this point? Or is this something that you have agency over? Do we create our Instagram narrative? And this is stuff that people ask all the time. And that's the thing is that's going to be true pretty much from here on out. We're in a postmodern space in that, you know, and this is why I guess I give my academic friends such a hard time is that in academia, people wanted to have coveted knowledge. Coveted language, coveted, you know, a space to be able to create aura around and be like the purveyors of it and the people that get to direct and show. So if you coined a term, you were like, oh yeah, that person coined that term, you know, cyberspace. Who coined that term? You know, William Gibson. Okay. But we don't have that much anymore. It's very rare that we're going to have that anymore. Not just because of the fact that it's hard to come up with new names, but because it's easy to look up what's been said, right? And that's only getting faster to do that. It's not getting slower. And so to be original at this point is very, very different than even 5 years ago or 15 years ago or 30 years ago or 50.
Yeah, that's something that always makes me laugh. I mean, it was sort of a metaphysical construct for the longest time, and now it's real. Like this idea, I had this original thought and nobody else thought of it. It's like, if anybody watched that show Connections that James Burke did in the 80s and then subsequent versions of it in his knowledge web, he showed in every case that these new leaps in understanding were happening simultaneously. Just one person got noted for it, but a bunch of people were thinking about it at the same time.
So I was asked to do a course overload. This semester, and they had me teach speech, which I'm not set up to teach speech. And the second chapter was the history of speech, which involves Plato, because he invented speech. And I was like, whoa! I started reading this. I was like, how am I supposed to teach this? Like, it's like. So like literally, like the white man taught us to speak. Okay, so, like and the canon of speech comes from the white man. And I was like, I just can't do this. I get it. I understand how this happened. I understand the mistakes and the revisionist history and everything. But I was like, it's 2019 in the fall, and I'm sitting here explaining to my students that the white man taught us how to speak in public.
Yeah, all history is revisionist history, right? It's never right. Yeah. I think we're at the end of the
quarter
of the space-time continuum.
All right.
So thank you, Joy. This has been a great conversation. Really,
we're at the end
it.
Of the X-axis.
Yeah. We're into the
Our samples
axis,
have been taken. Well, so I really appreciate you having me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's been great.
So thank you so much. And like, I'm going to be running this program. I don't know what's going to come of it. Most people that I talk to about what I do, they are amazed I have the job, wonder when I'll get fired, and also think that I should be promoted.
Learn more about Joy at mygeekylife.com or at cmcollective.org. The truly adventurous can talk to Dr. Joy at his high-end audio store, Dreaminoids, in San Antonio. With John Lepkoski and Maggie Duvall, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Protopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.